Today is lesson 4. As a matter of review, let's remember that to cut covenant in Hebrew is karath berith, karath meaning to cut, and berith meaning covenant. In English, then, we know that a covenant is a solemn, binding, irrevocable agreement. It's a promise that is made that is kept. It cannot be taken back. It was often made in the past by walking between the pieces of torn flesh of an animal. We looked first at the covenant between Jonathan and Samuel last week, and in review we saw that when Jonathan gave David his robe when they cut covenant, what he was doing was they were exchanging identities, so that when David put on Jonathan's robe, he was in essence putting on Jonathan, and that means that when someone looked at David, they should have seen another Jonathan. The robe symbolized identities. They were putting on each other's identities, therefore, in covenant to become one. Then we saw how that applied to us when we are exchanging robes with Jesus Christ. The robe that we give him is our humanity. He puts on our humanity. And the robe that he gives us is the robe of his righteousness. We put on Christ. We saw that the second thing that Jonathan gave to David after he gave him his robe was his armor, including his sword and his bow. We saw that the armor represents defense or protection, and then the belt, which holds all the armor together, was a symbol of a man's strength. So he was lending his strength to David as well as protecting him. And then we looked at how it was that Jonathan did act out on his covenant promises with David, even though it meant going against the wishes and desires of his own father, who was also the king. And about the exchange of the armor, we have a covenant partner as well. And he will protect and defend us, and he will avenge wrongs that are done to us. But we saw last week that he sometimes doesn't do them in the manner and in the timing that we would like. He does it in his own time, and because he has an eternal perspective, it may not even happen during our lifetimes. But in the meantime, our covenant defender gives us his strength. He has said that his grace is sufficient for us, for his power is perfected in weakness. So given his grace, we can endure all trials that we are meant to go through. He often doesn't deliver us out of, but rather through a trial when we go through it. Now in today's lesson, we're going to be looking again at the Abrahamic covenant. Then we'll move forward to the Mosaic covenant. Then we'll back up and come back to the Abrahamic covenant. And then we'll move forward again and go back to the Mosaic covenant. The reason we're doing this is to see the interrelationship of these. So let's begin by reviewing the beginning of the Abrahamic covenant. Isn't this an interesting picture? It shows Abraham in the deep sleep, and the smoking oven and the flaming torch are passing, it looks like they're cooking actually, but they're passing between the pieces of the torn flesh. The first thing that we looked at when we looked at Genesis 15, this is where the covenant with Abraham, God cuts this covenant with Abraham. The first thing we looked at in Genesis 15 was that God promised Abraham an heir from his own body and then told him to look outside at the stars overhead, the countless stars overhead, and said, "So shall your descendants be." And then we learn in verse 6 of Genesis 15 that at that point it says, "Abraham believed him and it was reckoned to him as righteousness." It is at that point that God justified him. If we were to use it in modern day parlance, we'd say that was the time that he got saved. Then, after that, God gave him some additional promises. In some earlier lesson, it took about 3 slides to list all the promises of the Abrahamic covenant, but they included a specific land forever, and they included the countless descendants, and it also included the seed of the woman, so that we knew that that shadow of a promise that was given in Genesis 3:15 now had some more form, because it was narrowed down to this family, this lineage of Abraham. The seed of the woman was going to come through him, and it was the Savior who would come from him. When he was instructed to, Abraham cut the animals in half, not the birds, but he cut the animals in half and he walked between them. And then we have the smoking torch and the smoking oven and flaming torch that walked or that passed between the pieces. And who did these pieces, these things represent? The smoking oven, God. That's right. These represented God. And at that point, I reminded you that when the Israelites were being led out in the wilderness, led out of Egypt, out of bondage, they were led by a pillar of smoke. And by night, it was a pillar of fire. So we have the same images of God that go back even that far. Actually, the Exodus happened later, but it's the same image. At the time that God made this promise to Abraham, he also gave him a prophecy. And he prophesied that Abraham's descendants would be enslaved in a land that was not theirs. Now, whether he was giving this prophecy in answer to Abraham's question of how do I know these things will be, or whether it was the covenant that God cut that was in response to the question, it occurred to me as I was thinking about this week that there might have been another reason that God gave this prophecy about the 400 years of slavery in a land that was not theirs before his descendants would come in and possess the land. And what I was thinking is this. Remember last week we were talking about the fact that God will avenge the wrongs that are done to us, but he takes the long view and sometimes he doesn't do it in our time frame. He often has his own time frame. So when he gave this this prophecy of the 400 years, I'm wondering if he was doing that to teach Abraham right then and there to take the long view about the fulfillment of God's promises. Abraham might not be around to see the fulfillment of that promises, but he would surely tell his descendants about it. And if they were keeping time or marking the calendar, just as Daniel did when he was in the Babylonian captivity, he was reading Jeremiah and he knew that it was the 70 years were about up. It was about time to go back. So perhaps he was doing this so that Abraham and his descendants would take the long view, and also so that Abraham would, because it was another 25 years before God fulfilled his promise to give Abraham an heir of the promise. Now, he took matters in his own hands and already had Ishmael, but he didn't get Isaac until another 25 years after this promise was made. So maybe the example for him was, the lesson for him was, I fulfill my promises, and they are sure and they are certain. They are yea and amen, but I will do them in my time. And this promise I'm making for you, who knew it was going to be a quarter of a century, and that he would be a century old before the promise would be fulfilled? I think that's something for us to remember, too. Something we can take away from this, too, is that our times are not his times. In fact, he doesn't even exist in time. So he will take care of us. He will walk us through the valley of the shadow of death. He may or may not deliver us out of it, but when he walks us through it, he takes the long view, and he's interested in our character development. So if he walks us through and doesn't deliver us out of it, or he doesn't avenge us of the wrongs done to us, we can be certain that he still keeps his promises. He is a covenant-keeping God. What we are looking at this week, therefore, is the binding nature, the seriousness of entering into covenant. If God is going to make a promise, we can rely upon it. We can walk in trust and in faith, knowing that he will keep his promises. And even though it took 25 years for God to fulfill the promise of the heir of Abraham's own body, through whom the covenant blessings would flow, he still kept it, as he kept the prophecy of the 400 years of enslavement. The next covenant that demonstrates the irrevocably binding nature, the serious nature of covenant, is one we looked at last week. Now, this wasn't in the homework last week, but we looked at it in class, and it was also covered in the tape when Kay looked at it. This was the one between Joshua and the men of Gibeon. This is covered in Joshua chapter 9. And we saw that God had commanded the Israelites to wipe out everybody in the promised land as they moved in. The reason was the time of judgment had arrived, and God was going to use the Israelites as his means of judgment of these people. He instructed them expressly, do not enter into covenant with them, do not marry, do not interact, just wipe them out. Well, the Gibeonites didn't know about this decree, but they certainly knew what the history of these Israelites were because they'd seen what had happened at Jericho and Ai. So they came and they tricked Joshua and the Israelites into making a covenant with them so that the Israelites would spare them, would not kill them. And the mistake that Joshua made was what? He didn't consult God on the matter. How many times do we fail to consult God before we move on the matter? But it didn't matter. God is serious about keeping covenant. We saw last week then that when the Gibeonites got into trouble, because the five Amorite kings and the other five kings allied themselves and attacked the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites sent word to Joshua at Gilgal and said, "Help! We're being attacked! Come to our defense!" And Joshua had to. These were people he was supposed to have wiped out. But because he had been fraudulently induced to enter into covenant with them, not only could he not wipe them out himself, but he was bound to be their covenant defender as well. And because he did honor the covenant, even though it was based on a lie, it was so serious that he had to honor it. And because he did honor it, then God honored the covenant that he had made with the Israelites. And he is the one who took over the battle and defeated the 10 kings. I said at that time when we looked at this covenant between Joshua and the Gibeonites that we'd be looking at it again. About 400 years, I think last week I said 350, but I think it was closer to 400 years later. By this time, Israel is no longer being ruled by the judges. It's got a king now, the first king, King Saul. Now we have to know, we can safely assume that Saul knew about this covenant with the Gibeonites because they were now the hewers of wood and drawers of water. So he knew why they were in these subservient positions. It's because the Israelites had been duped into making this covenant with him. And yet, Saul breaks the covenant with the Gibeonites, and we don't know exactly how he did it. We are told in 2 Samuel 21, all we know is that there's some reference to it in 2 Samuel chapter 21. It just says he killed some Gibeonites. We don't know what the circumstances were. We don't know how many he killed. All we know is that's what happened. Well, then after Saul was no longer the king and David was the king, there was this 3-year famine in Israel. And so David goes to the Lord and he says, "Why? What have we done? Is this a punishment for some reason?" And God says, "Yes, indeed. It's punishment for Saul having broken the covenant with the Gibeonites." That's how serious covenant is. God will punish breaking of covenant. So David, knowing that this is irrevocably done, I mean, they can't take back the killing of Saul's killing of the Gibeonites. So he calls in the Gibeonites and he offers them blood money. He says, "How much will it take to make you whole? And what are the damages that you would accept in this case?" And the Gibeonites, by this time, are pretty knowledgeable about covenant, and they stand on their covenant rights. When you cut a covenant and you cut an animal in two, you hack it in two, and you walk between the pieces, and you call down an oath, and you say, "May God do to me what I just did to these animals if I ever break this covenant." The Gibeonites knew this, and they said, "Blood for blood, life for life, you broke it, somebody's going to die." So what they said they would accept was they would accept 7 descendants of Saul as payment for Saul's having broken the covenant with the Gibeonites. And so that's what David does. To atone for Saul's violation of the covenant with the Gibeonites, David took the 2 sons of Rizpah. She was one of the concubines of Saul. And he took the 5 sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, and he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the mountain before the Lord. God is serious about keeping covenant. You know how sons were valued in that day. The five sons of the daughter of Saul were taken, and the 2 sons of Rizpah, they had no sons. This was just horrendous for these women that they lost all their sons. But you may have wondered why I have that picture up there. That's an interesting picture. This woman looks like a banshee, doesn't she? Beating off those birds. And there are the bodies of the seven young men, the descendants of Saul, who have been killed. Well, the picture tells us the rest of the story, what happened after these seven young men were killed. Their bodies were strung up there, and they were not given a proper burial. That's part of the humiliation, to not allow the body to be given a proper burial. So she, the Rizpah, it says, she took sackcloth and spread it for herself on a rock. And from the beginning of harvest until it rained on them from the sky, she allowed neither the birds of the sky to rest on them by day, nor the beasts of the field by night. This is a period of 3 to 4 months. This woman stayed outside in all kinds of weather, and she beat off the predatory birds, the vultures, and the other wild animals that would come and feed on the flesh of these dead bodies. So over the course of these 3 to 4 months, the bodies decayed, but they were not eaten by the animals. And this woman did this. This was her, how great her love was for her sons. When it was told David what she had done, then what he did was he went and he collected, it says he collected their bones. So maybe by this time they had rotted to the point that there were just bones hanging there. So he collected their bones, and he also collected the bones of Saul and Jonathan. Now remember, Saul and Jonathan were killed in a battle with the Philistines. And the Philistines apparently didn't let the Israelites take their bodies back. So he went and collected their bones, or what was left of their bodies, and the bodies of these seven young men, and he gave them a proper burial in the country, in the territory that was allotted to Benjamin. And it says, after that, God was moved by entreaty for the land. God is serious about keeping covenant. Let's go back to the Abrahamic covenant. What was the sign that God gave for the Abrahamic covenant? Anyone remember what that was? Circumcision was the sign that he gave for the covenant of circumcision. I have a lot of passages, cross-references, that we're going to look at today, beginning at Genesis 17, verse 9, and going through verse 14. This is how serious God was about keeping covenant. If he gave as circumcision as a sign of the covenant, and the people did not circumcise their sons on the eighth day, then they were to be cut off. Now, it's not clear who's to be cut off, but then we move ahead to the time of Moses, and we get to Exodus chapter 4, verses 24, and we see something happening as a result of God's commandment to circumcise the sons on the eighth. Exodus 4, verses 24 through 26. So God is so serious about keeping covenant that what was he about to do to Moses? He was going to kill him. He was going to literally cut him off. Because why? Because his son hadn't been circumcised. Now, isn't that interesting? Here's Moses, who's going to be the deliverer of the people. He's on his way to Egypt when this incident occurs, and he hasn't circumcised his own son. Did any of you ever wonder why on earth he had not? Well, his wife was a Midianite. That's exactly right. And he had spent 40 years on the backside of the desert. He'd probably become pretty, I started to say, westernized, Midianitized. He had become accustomed to their ways of doing things. And even if he had suggested it when he had a firstborn son, or when he had a son, he may have suggested it, the Bible doesn't say. And Zipporah probably went, ew, you've got to be kidding. And indeed, when she circumcised him, she complained about it too. It says she threw the foreskin at his feet. Yours said she touched Moses' feet with the child's foreskin. This is a picture from the Middle Ages of that particular event. But it says that she said, you are a bridegroom of blood to me. So I did some research on that, and I thought, what does that mean? What is she saying by that? And there were interpretations that, frankly, were all over the board. But the one that made the most sense to me is this. She's saying to him, the marriage bond between us is now sealed by blood, because I have saved your life by circumcising your son. And it's interesting to note that shortly after that, before he continued this journey, he went on by himself and he sent his wife and the kids back to Jethro, his father-in-law. He sent them back. And the writers are all over the board on that one too. Well, did she go back because she was so horrified that God almost killed their children, killed Moses because of this? Or was he sending them back because it would take a while before the child to heal, before they could continue the journey? And no one knows the answer to that. But it is interesting that it was Zipporah, the Gentile, the Midianite, the one who didn't even, well, if she knew about it, she obviously didn't like the custom, and she was the one who performed the circumcision. Now, the Abrahamic covenant had been in effect for about 400 years when this event took place. It looks like it took place in the Middle Ages, but it didn't. God had given in the Abrahamic covenant unconditional promises. All he asked in return was that the men should circumcise their baby boys on the eighth day. To circumcise your children was an act of obedience and faith. Now, did circumcision save the child? No, any more than baptism saves us. Nowhere does the Old Testament teach that circumcision was what saved anybody. We know it in the case of Abraham because we know from Genesis 15, verse 6, he got saved before he was circumcised. So we know that wasn't what saved him. Moreover, when Abraham was commanded to circumcise, he circumcised all the males in his house, including Ishmael. And we know that Ishmael was not in the line of the covenant blessings. So we know that it does not save. It was simply a symbol. It was a sign. A sign points to something. It is not the thing. It points to the thing. Circumcision was a sign of the covenant between God and man. Now, the interesting thing is that the Hebrew word that's used for the uncircumcised male being cut off from his people, it's kareth. The same word we use for to cut covenant, kareth berith. If he isn't circumcised, he shall be kareth'd. Is what it says. What does that mean? Does it mean or does it mean exiled? And the answer is nobody really knows. It could be either. The arguments in favor of it meaning that they get killed are the fact that God was about to kill Moses. That's a good one. And the other one example is that in the Noahic covenant, which we looked at the very first lesson, God said to Noah, all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood. So, and it was the same word there, kareth. So that's a possibility. I'm inclined to say that's what it means, given that God was so serious about it that he was about to kill Moses. On the other hand, though, John MacArthur says he thinks it just meant exiled, excommunication, to be put outside the camp. And since someone I esteem as highly as John MacArthur, if he says that, then I'm inclined to listen. We don't have to be dogmatic about this. I'm just saying that there are possible interpretations of this one and that the word is kareth. That's all you really need to remember about it. Why was circumcision the sign of the covenant? Well, we know that in a lot of the laws that were given later in the covenant of the law, looking back, we can see that a lot of them had to do with health benefits. The dietary restrictions about, well, you can't use the same utensils that you use on raw meat. You can't use those for vegetables and fruit. We know there's a very good reason not to expose your vegetables and fruit to the raw meat. So we know that a lot of these had health benefits. So, by the way, coincidentally, except we know it's not coincidental, did circumcision. It was a health measure in some senses because disease could be trapped in the folds of the foreskin. And historically, this is an interesting fact, Jewish women have had the lowest rate of cervical cancer. But that's really all incidental. There was another reason why God chose circumcision as the sign of the covenant that he was making with Abraham and with his generations thereafter. And there are two ways to look at this. One is that, this is what K. Arthur says, the sign of circumcision is in the outward part of a man's flesh closest to where his descendants come from. So we're looking at it. Remember, the covenant is not just with Abraham, but with his seed. So if it's going to be with them, then the cutting should be in the place that's closest to where the seed is coming from. That's one way of looking at it. The other is that since Adam, since the fall, all people are made in the image of Adam. We're all fallen. Fallen man procreates, produces, reproduces fallen children. So the covenant is there to remind you that there has to be a cleansing, a circumcision of our sinful hearts, that our hearts of stone have to be cut out and we have to be given hearts of flesh. But since this is the place closest to where the descendants come from, that's why circumcision was the sign of the covenant. Now, isn't that interesting? John MacArthur says, circumcision points to the fact that cleansing is needed at the very core of a human being. It's kind of interesting. Now, we have seen that common elements of covenant include cutting an animal in two so that there's blood that is spilled, separating it, walking between the pieces, and calling down maledictory oaths. May God do to me what I just did to this animal if I ever break the covenant. This was the cutting in the Abrahamic covenant, was the cutting off of the foreskin. That's where the blood was shed. So that the man was saying, if I don't obey God as my Lord and as my sovereign, then may I be cut off the way I cut off my own foreskin. That's how it fits with covenant. We're still on the subject of the seriousness of covenant and its binding and irrevocable nature. Let's go again with Moses. We saw that God established the Old Covenant. It's called the Old Covenant. It's called the Covenant of the Law. It's called the Mosaic Covenant. It's called the Law. All of these things refer to this same covenant which God established with the nation of Israel. And he did it through the agency, through the mediation of Moses. Exodus 24, verses 3 through 11. What's happening here? This is where Moses is reading to the people. And they ate and drank. So look at all the elements of covenant that were in this passage. First, we have the terms of the covenant being set out. Moses reads the terms of the covenant. Twice the people say, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Those are their oaths. All that the Lord has spoken, they will do. Then there's a memorial built. We have an altar with 12 pillars. So that's a reminder of the agreement, of the covenant that is being made. And then we have a sacrifice, blood is being shed. And then we have the sprinkling of the blood, half on the altar and the other half on the people. And this could symbolize the walking between the pieces of torn flesh, the sprinkling of in two different places could symbolize that. And then they had a covenant meal. So there's a lot of elements of covenant that's given in this one. That's why I wanted to go through and read the entire thing, so that we see all that there is in this one. When we look at the New Testament in Hebrews 9, 18 through 20, we can see how that passage interprets, is a commentary on the passage that was just read. So both covenants, the first covenant and the second covenant, were inaugurated with blood. And even though it didn't say it in the passage that we read out of Exodus, it tells us in Hebrews that the blood was also sprinkled on the book of the covenant as well as on the others. And it bound both parties to the terms of the covenant. And the people swore an oath, all that he has said, we will do. And then the sprinkling of the blood was the equivalent of walking between the two pieces. Now remember that what we're calling the Old Covenant, it's also called the Law, the Mosaic Law, the Covenant of the Law, this was conditional. Unlike the Abrahamic covenant, which was unconditional, this one was conditional. And it was conditioned on Israel's being obedient to God's commands. Well, what happened was that when the law was first given, and then the people, the first generation to exit out of, to go through the Exodus out of bondage to slavery in Egypt, when they were on the edge of entering into the promised land and the spies went in and scouted out the land and they came back with these pretty terrifying tales. And most of the people, it says their hearts melted like water and they said, oh, that we had stayed in Egypt and died there. Oh, it would be better if we died in the wilderness. And God said, fine. You have spoken your own sentence. It's what you wanted. That's what you said. As you have spoken, so it shall be. So an entire generation, everybody who was over 20 years old, I don't know if that means they're 21 and older or 20 and older, but at any rate, 20 was the cutoff point. Everybody 20 and older died in the wilderness. So that 40 years later, when they were about to enter into the promised land, the oldest ones of there, except for Joshua and Caleb, were 60 years old. Everybody else was younger. And if they were 20 years old or younger at the first reading of the law, it's unlikely they're going to have remembered it. So there's a second reading of the law. That's what Deuteronomy means anyway, is a second reading of the law. And at this point then, Moses is telling them, even though he's not going to go in with them, he's telling them once more. And that's what's recorded here. He's telling them, this is what you need to do. And this second generation is saying what the first generation said, which is that, oh, all that you said, yes, we're going to do it. Of course, we know what they didn't do. But this is what God told them. Deuteronomy 30, 15 through 20. So what was God promising to Israel would be the result of keeping the covenant? Blessings. They would have good health, prosperity, the land would be abundant. But if they didn't, then what? Curses, death, adversity, all sorts of things. And who is the witness for this one? Who is called to be witness? Heaven and earth. So God is saying, heaven and earth is a witness against you. If you fail to keep covenant, you will die. Covenant is serious. And he was trying to say, all you have to do is choose life. How do you choose life? By being obedient and holding fast to him. Generations later, after this second generation that did enter the promised land, after they were long dead and gone and the next generations had come and gone, God was still calling Israel to obey. Talk about forbearance. He was still calling Israel to keep his covenant of the law. They broke it generation after generation. In Jeremiah 22, God said that if they did not keep the covenant, then the house of Jerusalem would become a desolation. I don't think I gave this one to anyone. In Jeremiah 22, God says, if you will not obey these words, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, this house will become a desolation. And so it would be a desolation as a result of that. Because even pagan nations, when they saw what had happened to Israel, would recognize that this had happened to Israel because they had forsaken the covenant. They had violated the terms of the covenant. The point that we need to remember about this is that when God says, I promise you I will do something, if it's a good thing, you can be assured, you can be certain that he will do it. If God promises, if you don't obey, I will destroy you, you can be equally certain he will keep that promise as well. God keeps the covenants that he makes. And since the Israelites broke the covenant, God gave them over to their enemies. Jeremiah 34, verses 17 through 22, but first let me give you some background on this one. Part of the Mosaic law was that if a Hebrew, an Israelite, became indebted, fell into poverty, he could sell himself or his family into slavery with another Israelite family. At the end of every 7 years, they were all supposed to be set free so that he could go back to his family. He would not be enslaved forever. That was the law. Well, they hadn't been very good about keeping this law. They were keeping them in bondage after that. So at the time of King Zedekiah, by this time the kingdom had split. We're talking just about the southern kingdom, which was Judah and Benjamin and a few of the Levites. At this point, there had been a renewal of this covenant. And the people had said, yeah, I know, we're really not obeying that. Okay, from now on, every seventh year, we're going to free all the slaves that we have taken into bondage because they had some kind of debt. So they started to do it. And what was the circumstances that were going on was that the Babylonians were at their door. And they were all turning to God, and God was saying, well, you guys didn't obey the law. Okay, we'll obey. We'll all let our slaves go, all right? Well, then what happens is that the Egyptian army came up and diverted the Babylonian army, and the pressure was off. And what did the people do? They went right back. Okay, 17 through 22. There are two interesting things about this passage. One is that it sets out in great detail how the covenant was cut. Verse 18, it says, "The covenant was made before me. They cut a calf in two and passed between its parts. The officials of Judah did it. The officials of Jerusalem did it. The court officers and the priests and all the people of the land walked between the parts of the calf." So here's a very graphic description of how they had entered into covenant. And then he says, but then they transgressed it. You wouldn't release the captives when I told you to, so I'm going to release the sword, the pestilence, and the famine on you. Sounds a lot like Revelation, doesn't it? Sword, pestilence, and famine are coming. By this time, I think we've looked at enough passages to have gotten the point that God takes covenant very, very seriously indeed. But an indication of how far American society has gone the other direction in taking covenant lightly is this. A year ago, October, my younger daughter was then in her first year of law school, and I went up in October to visit her, and she got permission for me to attend a couple of classes with her. And the first class we went to was in property law. And that day they were talking about leases. If somebody owns a piece of property, he's the lessor. He leases it to the lessee. The lessee pays rent. They enter into a contract. The contract is called a lease. This was a property law class, but because they were talking about leases, it was more about contract law than about property law per se. The assignment that day was that the students were being asked to make public policy arguments why lessees, the ones who lease the property, should not have to keep their part of the agreement. Why they should be allowed by public policy to break the contract that they had entered into freely, no undue influence, no fraud in the inducement, totally of their own free will, why they should be allowed to do it. And I sat there appalled, thinking, how far have we come? And at one point, finally, one young man raised his hand and he said, then why do we even have contracts? Why do we bother entering into contracts if we can't enforce them and they're not even enforceable because of public policy? And I thought, I was thinking exactly. And that's an indication. If things become inconvenient for us, then we no longer want to honor our commitments. God doesn't care if there was fraud in the inducement. God doesn't care if somebody tricked you and lied. You will keep the covenant to the point of defending this person whom you were supposed to have killed. Joshua was supposed to have killed the Gibeonites. That's how serious God is about covenant. But this Old Testament truth about God being serious about covenant, it's the same thing in the New Testament when we enter into covenant with Jesus Christ. This covenant is also inaugurated with blood, and there is either a walk between the two pieces of torn flesh, or else there is a sprinkling of blood that goes with it. The Old Testament sacrificial system of sprinkling foreshadowed Jesus' blood being shed on the cross for the forgiveness of sins. Isaiah had prophesied that Jesus would sprinkle many nations, and his blood is effective in forgiving our sins. But on that sprinkling of the many nations, that prophecy was fulfilled when Jesus said that the cup was his blood of the covenant, which was poured out for the forgiveness of sins. The unleavened bread that Jesus was tearing was unleavened for a reason. Remember that the occasion was the Passover. At the time of the Passover, one of the things that the Jews did was they had unleavened bread. That means no yeast, okay? Why did they make unleavened bread at the time of Passover? They were leaving in a hurry. There wasn't time to let the dough rise. They just had to put it together, bake it, and go. So they have the unleavened bread that was there. This, in the New Testament, in the New Covenant, came to represent the body of Jesus Christ, so that when he tears it, he's representing the tearing of his body in two. The shedding of his blood is going to be the sacrifice, because his body is going to be what is going to be torn in two. We have the veil of the temple being rent in two. It's another picture of the body of Christ being sacrificed into two. His body represented it. Now, in the Passover supper, besides the unleavened bread and the bitter herbs and whatever else they also had four different cups of wine, and each one of the four represented something. The third cup that they did in this Passover supper represented the blood of the lamb that they had sacrificed while they were still in Egypt, and it was the last curse, the death of the firstborn, and they were told to kill a lamb and paint its blood on the lintels and the doorposts over their home. And if the angel of death coming through saw the blood on the door and the lintel, doorposts and the lintel, the angel of death would pass over that house and the firstborn son would not die. So that was the cup of wine that symbolized that. It was at that point that Jesus said, this was the cup that was the blood of the covenant, which was poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. So that if the blood of his sacrifice, this perfect unblemished sacrifice, is painted over the doorposts and lintel of our hearts, then the angel of the second death will pass over us, and we will experience only the first death unless he comes before we die. We will not experience the second death as a result. So he picked that third cup for a reason. In the old covenant, under the Mosaic law, the sacrifices were made continually, ongoing, because it says in Hebrews, the blood of animals could never take away sin. But this sacrifice was a once-for-all sacrifice because it was effective in taking away sin. Why is it called a new covenant? We need to understand it's not new in the sense that the old covenant, the law, was a covenant of works. It wasn't. Remember that man has always been saved through faith, by faith. And so men in the Old Testament times were saved by looking forward to the cross, even if it was only a vague idea of what the promise would entail. And on the other side of the cross, those of us in New Testament times are looking backward at the finished work of Christ on the cross. Nevertheless, it is still saved by faith. All of us are saved by faith. It is a covenant of grace. It is not a covenant of works. So when we are in the new covenant, we are getting the blessings of the new covenant through the Abrahamic covenant. Both of those two are everlasting. See the red? Doesn't look very red up there, but it's red. Where it says everlasting, those two are everlasting, and the Mosaic covenant, the old covenant, was only temporary. So when we say new covenant, we're only saying new in the sense that the old pointed to it, and when the new came, the old faded away. That's all. Not new in the sense of saved by faith, by grace or faith now, rather than by works. New only in the sense that the shadow was pointing to something. If I'm standing here and the sun is here, the shadow is going to be over here. So if you're standing here and the sun's over here, your shadow's over here. And you see the shadow first, but when you see the substance, you don't need to look at the shadow anymore. So when the new came in, the shadow faded out. Jesus kept the law. He said, I came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And he fulfilled it in two senses. One, in the sense that his life was absolutely perfect. He was the only one who ever kept the law in every jot and tittle. He was the only one that kept it. And the second thing was that he fulfilled the law in the sense that the law said, if it is broken, the penalty is death. And we saw in Romans chapter 3, the end of it, that a law is established by enforcing its penalty. Just like that boy was asking in the law school, why do we have contracts if they're not enforceable or they're not going to be enforced? Why do we have criminal laws if we're not going to enforce them? A law is established when it is enforced. So Jesus fulfilled the law in that sense also when he paid the penalty that the law demanded for breaking it. She said the blood was applied with hyssop, which was a common weed available to anyone. And it was a picture of our faith, and that it is available to anyone. So when we're talking about old and new, we're just talking about shadow and substance. The old deliverance was one from Egypt, out of bondage in Egypt, over to the promised land of Canaan. But spiritually, what happens to us is that we are transferred, we are delivered out of the realm of Satan over to the realm of God, out of the realm of sin over to the realm of salvation, out of the realm of death over into life. So that's all that is meant by the old and the new. And Passover was transformed then into the Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians 5:7 says, Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast. So we now eat the bread and we drink the blood, not to remember the Passover, but to remember what covenant was cut for us. We have a covenant meal. We have the bread, the body torn in two. We have the wine, which is representative of the blood, the spilled blood. And through the spilled blood, through the torn pieces of the bread, the flesh, through the torn veil of the temple, we enter then into covenant with God. So we are to remember that Jesus took a walk into death in order for us to be able to enter into covenant with him. And covenant is serious business. And that's what we should be thinking about the next time we partake of the Lord's Supper or communion, however, whichever term that you use when you do it. We saw that in 1 Corinthians, the church was not taking the tradition of the Lord's Supper very seriously. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 26 through 34. This is a little girl that's about to take communion for the first time. And I think she's about to take it in an unworthy manner. Matthew 5:23-24 says, if therefore you are presenting your offering at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, then come and present your offering. This little girl has a problem with somebody. She needs to go and get that straightened out before she dares to go and take communion for the first time. So what does it mean to partake in an unworthy manner? Unconfessed sin, not a clean heart. I think those are the things that we mostly think about. I added that one with the problem with your brother because that little girl seemed to have one, and that's often the case. We've got an issue, an unresolved issue that we have with someone. We need to be reconciled first. Now, before the passage, it's talking about divisions and factions. And remember that Kay said, if God is in covenant with you, and God is in covenant with somebody else, then how you treat that other person is very important because God has covenanted to be their covenant defender. So if you're going to do wrong to them, think about who's coming after you as their covenant defender. So we need to remember how we treat one another. These factions and divisions are unacceptable. Other ways that we can take it in an unworthy manner are just to view it as a ritual and not be thinking about much of anything. Or we're just indifferent. Or we have an unrepentant heart. You said unconfessed sin. Or one of you said unconfessed sin. But what about if you know about the sin, but you're not sorry? And not only you're not sorry, you have no intention of doing anything about it. Or you're bitter. Or you have some kind of an ungodly attitude. All of these things mean that we shouldn't be taking. We should just let it pass by. Don't take it in an unworthy manner. That's how serious covenant is. And it says in this passage that because these people were taking it in an unworthy manner, not watching out for one another, but rather dividing themselves from one another, because they were doing this, he said, many of you are sick and some of you sleep. That means die. That means he's taking them out of the world so that they don't have to go to judgment, at least not at that point. We know that sin must be judged either here or hereafter. And we know that judgment begins with the household of God and it goes out from there to the unsaved. So we don't want to be in a position where God has to chastise us and judge us so that we are sick or even taken out of the world. The last subject we want to talk about is what is the relationship between faith and obedience. And when I say faith, I could also say belief. Those are synonyms. In the Greek, it is the same word. In the Greek, the word is pistis. It means a firm, strong conviction of religious truth, moral persuasion. Do you know what that's a picture of? It's an olive tree. It's the trunk of an olive tree. The olive trees last for centuries. That's a pretty firm, strong conviction. Those roots would go down quite a bit. And look at the size of the trunk of that tree. And so we know that faith is the root of the Christian life. Are we saved by faith? No, well, yeah, sort of. By grace you are saved through faith. We are saved by Christ. If we say that we are saved by faith in the sense that we mean we're saved by Christ, then it's become a work. Faith is the channel. It is the way through which we are saved, but it is Christ who saves us. So faith is the channel. So I put it's the sap, it's the root through which the sap of the Holy Spirit flows. So the Holy Spirit comes to us through the channel of faith. It's hard to use these metaphors and get them straight, but are you following what I'm trying to say? It is Christ who saves us. It is not our faith. Faith is more than intellectual assent. She talks in the DVD, Kay does, about, oh, I believe. That's all I have to do. I have to say I believe. Prayer, and then it doesn't matter what I do the rest of my life, I'm saved. Don't think so. That's not what it means. Because the demons knew without a doubt who Jesus was. And I don't think they're going to heaven. The demons believe and they shudder. The demons' faith was manifested by their fear and by their hatred of him. Faith is a commitment and a surrender to the truth, and it results in a life of obedience, a surrender and a commitment to him. Obedience is an outward manifestation of an inward birth. We are commanded to be baptized after we come to faith. It is an outward act that is a symbol of something that's already happened on the inside. Obedience is the same thing. It's an outward manifestation of something that's happened on the inside. Faith is a belief which results in behavior that will accord with what you believe. We've talked about this many times. What you believe will govern what you do. What comes out of a man's mouth is what is in his heart or his mind. So our lives will be the evidence of our faith, or they'll be like that dead tree. There'll be evidence of the lack of our faith, that there wasn't any faith there. It wasn't a real faith at all. James says that faith without works is dead. If you've been made alive, you're going to produce fruit. You're either going to produce fruit, much fruit, or more fruit, but you're going to produce something at some stage of your life. You're going to produce it. Now let's look at those cross references. The point of these cross references is that faith is linked to obedience. It manifests itself in obedience, and unbelief is linked to disobedience. The first one we're going to look at is Hebrews 3:18-19. They were not able to enter because of unbelief. And in the prayer verse, it says they were disobedient. So disobedience equals unbelief, or the other way around. Unbelief equals disobedience. So that tells you that biblically defined belief will affect your behavior, and it will show itself in obedience if it is there. Romans 1:5. The obedience of faith among all the Gentiles. This is a little unclear. Remember that I told you when you're not really sure what your translation is saying, it's a good idea to look at other translations to see if you can get it. The obedience of faith. NIV says the obedience that comes from faith. And I think that's the best translation for us now. It means obedience characterizes faith and it proceeds from faith. You have faith, it's manifested in obedience. So when it says the obedience from faith, I think when it says the obedience that comes from faith is the best example of that one. Romans 2:8-9. Again, he's talking about the contrast of the righteous and the unrighteous, and the unrighteous do not obey the truth. That tells us, by the way, that truth, absolute truth, is a person to be obeyed. And he requires a response. I also have 16:26 up there, but it's the same phrase, the obedience of faith. So it's obedience that leads to faith that leads to obedience. Let's look then at 1 Peter 2. So it says, if they don't believe, then they're disobedient to the word. Again, the same principle is tied there. 1 Peter 4:17. So it indicates that those who do not obey the gospel of God, those are not of the household of faith. They're unbelievers. That's a clear indication that it's talking about the same thing again. 2 Thessalonians 1:7-9. So those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ will pay the penalty of eternal destruction. Last week we talked about the exchange of the belt in covenant, and we said that the belt symbolized a man's strength. And it's relatively easy for us to understand, maybe not so easy to implement, but we can understand it, that what we're trying to do is exchange our weakness for his strength. When we are weak, he is strong. And we also talked about what do we have to give him? If this is an exchange, do we have some kind of strength that we could give to our covenant partner? And then we looked at a picture of Mary Magdalene, and we saw that, well, she loved him with all her heart, soul, mind, and strength. And that when we love him supremely, the way Mary Magdalene did, then we are exchanging. That's how we give him our strength. Well, along the same lines, we can demonstrate the strength of our love. We shall love the Lord with all our strength. We can demonstrate the strength of our love by obedience. Faith is demonstrated by obedience, but we can also demonstrate our love by obedience. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. He who does not love me does not keep my words. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. So what is our responsibility as those who have entered into the new covenant by grace through faith? We are to walk in obedience, and we are to warn others of the seriousness of covenant and its binding nature. The questions we need to be asking ourselves are these. We have exchanged robes with Christ. So does that mean that when other people look at us, that they see his robe of righteousness? We have exchanged armor with him. Does that mean that we defend the honor of his name when he is being maligned or defamed? Does it mean that we honor his name in all that we do and we say and how we interact with others? And does it mean that we refrain from taking revenge when it would feel so good to do so, but we remember that it's not ours to do? Because we have exchanged belts, do we rely on his strength when we are weak? And do we love him with all our strength? Does our covenant relationship supersede every other relationship that we have? When it does, we are honoring our covenant partner. The hymn that I chose has all kinds of references to covenant, and yet the word is not used. The longer you study covenant, the more you're going to see it in all kinds of places. For example, in this hymn, which I'll read in just a minute, it talks about the binding nature of a covenant relationship. It doesn't talk about covenant relationship, but it's talking about our relationship with Christ, and it talks about its binding nature. It talks about the fact that we are his friends. Friends is a covenant term. It talks about the fact that this relationship is permanent. Permanence is another element of it. And it talks about the fact that he gives us his strength. He gives us his belt. It talks about the fact that he is our covenant defender, although it doesn't say covenant defender. And then it also talks about what we should be remembering and thinking about each time we are taking communion. So all of these elements of covenant are in this hymn. Lord, we have come at your own invitation, chosen by you to be counted as friends. Yours is the strength that sustains our vocation. Ours a commitment we know never ends. Here at your table, confirm our intention ever to cherish the gifts you provide. Teach us to serve without pride or pretension, led by your Spirit, Defender, and guide. When at your table, each time of returning, vows are renewed and our courage restored, may we increasingly glory in learning all that it means to accept you as Lord. So in the world where each duty assigned us gives us the chance to create or destroy, help us to make those decisions that bind us, Lord, to yourself in obedience and joy. Amen.